is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jane Velez Mitchell is with us. She's a journalist, host of Jane Unchained, janeunchained.com. Jane, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I wanted to talk about body cams and police. I've been, the principal call for action of the Michael Brown family, it has been to require that every police officer in America be wearing a body cam continuously. I thought that was a great idea. I've been pushing it on the program, but I've had a number of people call from towns where they are using body cams or where they've had long experience with dash cams. And it seems that more often than not, when the police are involved in an altercation where they might reflect poorly on the police, for some reason the body cams malfunction. I'm curious your take on all this.
Well, that's an interesting conspiracy theory. Every day brings a new conspiracy theory. I think overall, dash cams on every officer who is patrolling in America, plus dash cams on every squad car patrolling in America, would go a long way toward ending the kind of divisions and the anger and the hostility we've seen in Ferguson. Think about it. Had there been a camera on Officer Wilson at the time, we wouldn't have to be arguing. We wouldn't have to have this global debate over whether Michael Brown's hands were raised or whether they were like this as he charged toward the officer. We would see.
Or did
what
he even
happened.
Charge toward the officer?
Right. That's what I'm saying. Some people say he was surrendering with his hands up, surrendering peacefully. Others say he was like this in a charge motion, which would lend credence to the officer's claim that he shot him in self-defense. And so we wouldn't be arguing about it. We
right.
wouldn't be filled with conjecture.
No, I agree. And I'm like I said, I'm still a fan of body cameras. But I just two caveats. Okay, the first one was, as I said, there are and you can Google this. You can easily find this. It's not a conspiracy theory. Very very frequently, when civilians make complaints against police who are wearing body cameras, the body camera was malfunctioning, the memory card can't be found, the thing wasn't charged, it wasn't turned on, whatever.
Well,
fill in the blanks.
Let me say this.
No, well, I have a solution for this, if I may.
Human nature. You know, police reports have been doctored probably since there were police reports.
No, I get that, and I'm trying to offer a solution here. Right now, the presumption of innocence in the American justice system is with the defendant. The presumption of guilt has to be demonstrated by the court. However, there are exceptions. The most famous exception is the breathalyzer. When a police officer asks you to blow into a breathalyzer, if you say no, you have lost your presumption of innocence. You now have to prove your innocence. What if a police officer, when confronted with a civilian claiming that the police officer broke the law or broke policy, if they had turned off their body camera, as it clearly has happened and has happened in a number of situations, they turned off their body camera, they lose their presumption of innocence. Now they have to demonstrate that they themselves are innocent rather than the other person having to prove that they're guilty. What do you think?
I agree. I think it should be a fireable offense if you turn off your body cam. And as for them, quote unquote, malfunctioning, what we do, well, as you know, is you have a microphone, you always have two potential mics. If one drops out, you have another that's going to back it up.
Right.
So that's what they should do. Here's the problem with our justice system, reactive justice. Oh, they couldn't afford to have badge cams in Ferguson. They were in the process of installing some form of badge cam.
Well, they couldn't afford to have tasers, apparently, either.
Yeah, and yet now that all hell's broken loose, oh, let's throw caution to the winds. Money's no object. You know the millions of dollars it's going to take, not just the investigative work, but cleaning up the mess in Ferguson. So
oh, yeah.
This is our reactive justice system. We, and I'll tell you something, it's got to end. The millennials don't like it. I think that those of a certain generation love the conflict. I mean, that's human nature, whether it's Shakespeare or reality TV. You don't go to reality TV to watch ladies sitting around politely having conversation. You want table flippers. You want hair pullers.
Right.
It's the same thing with our culture. I believe that our cultural forces created this horrific conflict in Ferguson that unfortunately was seen around the world. And really, I felt that while there are tremendous problems with racial profiling, there are tremendous problems with police brutality, this was not the case to make Exhibit A.
I don't think that we get to make that choice. The circumstances conspire. What is it? You know, man plans and God laughs.
Exactly.
You know, the circumstances are such that this is the case that we're talking about. The other concern that I had about body cameras, and I'd love to bounce it off you if you don't mind.
Sure.
We're talking with Jane Velez Mitchell, journalist and host of Jane Unchained, JaneUnchained.com. Is this the technology that you and I are talking about? Is basically a camera that's connected to a recording device that's located on the police officer's body. That is not the current state of the art. The current state of the art of technology would be a body camera which is connected to the cloud, which is connected continuously to the local police department, and the officer wearing a pair of Google glasses, or at least a police officer version of it, so that as soon as that body camera sees your face, facial recognition software kicks in, instantly recognizes you out of all the 300 million people in America, presents for the officer the information on the screen that he's seen projected into space in front of him, your name, your address, your age, your arrest record, anything about you that might prejudice him or her in one way or the other. A, that concerns me. And B, that because that police officer is performing a public function, there's a certain required level of transparency, and if it's not continuously transparent, it's certainly transparent through things like a Freedom of Information Act filing. Right now we're talking about community policing and how we need more Officer Katies, you know, this woman who in Madison, Wisconsin, patrols by walking the beat, one of the worst neighborhoods in town, and everybody loves her. She's a white woman in a black neighborhood, and the kids follow her around, and she's just, she's a great cop. I wonder how many parents are going to say to their 12-year-olds, yeah, go out and talk to Officer Katie, if they know that their 12-year-old is going to immediately have her face put into a facial recognition database, and every word she says is going to be recorded forever, and it's going to be in a database that's equally accessible to the local police department and the NSA.
Well, here's my thought on all of this. The camera, I think it was Dan Rather who wrote a book called The Camera Never Blinks. The camera does not have a political party. It doesn't have a racial preference. It is a camera. It simply records. So I believe that badge cams will help everybody involved. There have been cases of police officers being accused of things that they haven't done. Indeed, in the Ferguson case, there were claims by some people that, for example, Dorian Johnson, the young man who was with Michael Brown, that this officer just pulled up and basically became incredibly aggro and attacked them right off the bat. And so if the camera reveals that accusation isn't true, that's going to help the police. On the other hand, if there is a case of police brutality and police often forget they're on camera or they have lost control of themselves and an act occurs, that is also caught on tape.
No, I get all that.
I agree with you 100%. We are technologically behind the eight ball when it comes to anything in government. I have a phone where I can see my elderly mother sitting in a chair 24/7 by hitting, I have an app.
Right.
Now, why is it that I can figure that out and that there's a technology for that, but there isn't more high tech?
But do you want that? I mean, as a libertarian, do you want the government profiling you every time you bump into a police officer?
Well, let me say this. First of all, I think all of this should give pause to those who are right to carry advocates, because if the government takes over, it's not going to be a battle on the streets with a pistol. It's going to be them looking at us with their high tech surveillance methods. That's how they will control the population.
Oh, yeah. We already have drones over American cities. Interesting. Jane Velez Mitchell, host of Jane Unchained. JaneUnchained.com is the website. Jane, thanks for dropping by.
Thanks for having me.
Great talking with you. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, body cams, are we on the edge of a police state, or is this the magic bullet, or kind of none of the above, all of the above, something in between? I think this is just really fascinating, and I think that a lot, as is so often the case with the media, a lot of the stuff, a lot of the nuance, a lot of the hey, let's think this through to the next logical thing, like, oh, there's WMD in Iraq. Oh, let's go bomb them. Nobody said, well, what do we do then? Right? I mean, literally nobody said that. Nobody was saying it in the media. Apparently nobody was saying it in the Bush White House. So let's put body cams on every cop in America. What then? I mean, if they, let's say that the body cam, it doesn't have to be, you know, one of these big clip-on giant things. It could just be Google Glass. Google Glass has a camera in it. Everything the police officer's looking at, the Google Glass is seen. Why not have cops wear Google Glass? But then, you know, I mean, this is the state of the art, right? It's the most sophisticated of the technologies that are out there for doing this kind of thing. But then the question, and then what happens if the output of that Google Glass is connected by Bluetooth to the car, and the car has enough, you know, voltage and amperage, enough wattage, enough power to be providing a continuous stream of the output of that Google Glass and a continuous feedback to it of everything that the police officer's seen. Now, hey, if thinking as a police officer, I'd say, wow, that's really going to expand my possibilities. If I get lost, I can, you know, say, show me a map, tell me how to get out of here. A lot of things that police officers right now are having to stop doing and lean over. They got a laptop next to them in their car, which is, you know, impossible to do when you're driving. A lot of things that they're doing right now in basically 1990s technology could be done simply with a command. Simply say Google Glass, bring up the local map. Give me a map. But it's different. I mean, if you or I are wearing it, well, okay, you know, we could even run facial recognition software against what? Maybe a Facebook database or something, or a Google image database. But the police have something far different. Particularly police departments that might have gotten a little anti-terrorism money, and they're a little tied into the CIA and the NSA, and they're, you know, and that's happening. We're seeing this integration now of our local police departments along with our national spying agencies, basically. So are we a step closer to a national police state when every police officer becomes another eyeball for Big Brother? And that would, you know, which presents a real conundrum for progressives or liberals or people like Chuck Schumer, who says, you know, we need to be embracing big government in a time when there are many of us, both on the left and the right, who are concerned that, you know, government might be too intrusive, that between the Supreme Court and our military, the NSA, the stuff that Ed Snowden revealed, and the contractors thereof, and the hundreds of billions of dollars associated with the contractors thereof. Some of us, and I just speaking for myself, I mean, you know, I used to always go down 9th Street here on Washington, D.C. to get down to the waterfront where Louise and I live. And there used to be a traffic cam that was always in that tunnel where there's a curve in the tunnel and they catch people when they were speeding. And it had been privatized. The city had hired a private corporation to do it. And they were nailing people by taking pictures of the license plates. Well, they're also taking pictures of the people in the car, and they can subject them to facial recognition. It's like, this is starting to creep me out. What about you? 20 minutes past the hour. Fair and only slightly unbalanced, Tom Hartman here with you. This is the, you know, it's like, when we went into Iraq, we didn't think, oh, this WMD, let's take down, you know, let's bomb Iraq and kill off Saddam and fire the entire army. Yeah, great. Nobody said, well, actually Colin Powell said, but nobody listened to him. What are you going to do next? So let's say we just go right to the state of the art. Instead of the president appropriating $260 million or $70 million, I've heard different reports, different amounts, depending on, you know, how it's going to be done, and who's going to be for body cameras that will be a great new opportunity for some new defense contractor to come up with, you know, some kind of fancy camera and wires and buttons and switches and things. And, you know, what if they just use Google Glass, right? A pair of glasses with a camera in the corner and only one side has a lens, and the lens, you know, you can essentially projects things into your field of vision. It's sort of like Terminator. RoboCop. Excuse me. Thank you. Shane knows his movies. I don't. It's like RoboCop. And so as the police officer's driving down the street, every car that goes in the opposite direction if your face is caught by his glass, instant facial recognition. Oh, wait a minute. That guy's got a warrant. He didn't pay his parking tickets. Or that guy was at a demonstration 3 weeks ago. I wonder if he's going to plan another one. Maybe I should follow him. I mean, this is the thing. And I touched on this, I think, yesterday. Last week, I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday of last week, Louise and I went to see, it was last weekend. It was a week ago, Sunday. We went to see the new Ed Snowden movie. It's called Citizen Four, which is how he signed his initial correspondences with Laura Poitras when he was saying, I've got some things for you. And the point that the movie made, and these are my words, not those of the filmmakers. In fact, I shouldn't even say the point the movie made. The point that I got out of the movie was that there is a certain, not necessary, but useful apparatus for a police state. Right? If China wants to know what, you know, all their citizens are doing. They just, you know, put cameras on every street corner. They put cameras in the police cars. They have the technology. We invented it to monitor everybody's computer, to monitor everybody's cell phone, to turn on and off the cameras and the microphones whenever they want. And you've got one in all probability around you. We did a story a week and a half ago or so about the guy who read the terms and conditions on his new smart TV. Turned out his TV, which he thought was so cool because you hook it up to the internet and you're sitting in front of it and you can say, tune to CNN. Tune to Channel 4. And it just does it. Or you can even move your hands and say, shrink the picture and put another, you know, you can give it commands and you can do physical things because it's got a camera that's continuously watching you and a microphone that's continuously listening to you. Turns out that's going to some third party, some private corporation. And in the terms and conditions, they're saying, don't do anything private in front of the camera or in front of the microphone because, you know, it's being recorded.
Really?
So what happens if absolutely everything that's going on that officer's body cam isn't just stored in a body cam? It's not just stored in some little memory chip that gets pulled out if the officer's accused of something. But instead, it is continuously streaming to police headquarters, which has a continuous real-time link with the NSA, the CIA, and the FBI, and the state police. And everybody that police officer sees, their facial recognition protocol gets hit, and they get identified. And increasingly, we're moving into the world where there's nothing you can do where if we had a president who is crazy enough or paranoid enough, he could flip on the police state. Now, right now, President Obama is not that guy. You know, right-wing paranoia and the Tea Party notwithstanding, they're convinced he is. The empirical evidence is pretty much lacking. But the apparatus is there. The NSA has gotten that intrusive into our lives. And local police could become and have gotten that militarized. I mean, in 2004, I was in Minneapolis, as I recall, is where the Republican National Convention was. And they were busting down doors and arresting kids who were simply planning to go protest the Republicans. Just planning to protest them. But they were using, in many cases, snitches. They were using old-fashioned technology, you know, embed a person inside the movement. What if they just turned on the cell phones of those people and listened to everything they said? What if they had a smart TV in their room and they turned on the smart TV camera? What if, when the police officers confronted them, every single cop had a Google Glass or had a camera on, and that camera is streaming real-time information back to headquarters, And so they literally know where every protester is at every moment and what they're doing. And for the rest, if you're one of those protesters, for the rest of your life, that data is there and it's stored. And any old time they want, they can pull it out and say, you know, we're going to charge you with being a terrorist. You just lost all your rights. Because under the Patriot Act, you don't even have to be charged by a jury of your, you know, you don't even have to have a trial before a jury of your peers. You don't even have to meet the reasonable doubt standard. We're just going to throw you in Guantanamo for the next 50 years. What kind of president could do that? Frankly, I think Rick Santorum is in my mind, the leading candidate on the Republican side for a guy who is dim enough and frightened enough. Because that's what it takes. He's not very smart and very scared to do this kind of thing. That's what George W. Bush, 2003.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Well, really, George W. Bush, 2002, after 9/11, you know, a danger, but one he blew all out of proportion. Him and Dick Cheney, so terrified little men. Look what they did to this country. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's 28 minutes before the hour. There's a lot in the news. The death of the middle class. What if we're wrong about depression? The bank in North Dakota is outperforming Wall Street. Florida has just gutted their energy efficiency goals. I mean, it's all kinds of very strange stuff going on. Dar Jamail has a new piece out. We had him on the program a week or so ago about climate change and his concern that we're actually looking at a species extinction event. The Discovery Channel is going to be doing a TV special on extinction events, and they're going to focus on both the KT, which was the asteroid that hit the Earth 65 million years ago, killed the dinosaurs, and the Permian 250 million years ago, which was caused by global warming and destroyed 95% of all life on Earth. That should be interesting. So a lot going on. There's an interesting piece by Travis Geddes, an interview with Gregory Clark, a researcher at the UC Davis. He says, I've crunched the numbers and the American dream is dead. Meanwhile, with regard to body cams and police officers, this from Reuters, Albuquerque cop who fatally shot woman fired over camera lapse. He was not put in jail. He was not charged with the crime, at least so far as I can tell from the story, but he was fired. An Albuquerque police officer who shot and killed a 19-year-old woman in April was fired from the police force for failing to follow an order to turn on his uniform camera during all citizen contacts. He was fired for, quote, insubordination and untruthfulness, end quote. The U.S. Department of Justice has them under an agreement as a consequence of patterns of excessive force with deadly consequences. In other words, this is a rogue police department in Albuquerque, New Mexico, according to the Department of Justice, it appears. And then this guy's attorney says, come on, give me a break. Thomas Grover is Deere's attorney. He says, if they fire every officer who doesn't turn on his uniform camera, they won't have anyone left on the department. Well, that's why you don't say you must turn your camera on or else. You say if you don't turn your camera on and a citizen alleges that, you know, you did something inappropriate, you shot somebody, you hit somebody, you flashed somebody, I don't care what it is. If a citizen alleges it, if your body camera's not on, we're going to assume that the citizen is right. And the burden of proof to demonstrate your innocence falls to you. Really simple. But do you want all that information going in real time to every police agency in the country? Swallow hard, right? Jerry in Spring Lake, North Carolina. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind?
Well, there's so many possible solutions to some of the problems, but the one that got me calling you was about the body cameras and so forth.
Uh-huh.
The fact of the matter is that in many states, it's against the law to record a police officer in pursuit of his duty.
No longer. Supreme Court ruled on that about 8 months ago and said that it is.
They finally did say that it was okay. Well, there's still exceptions to it.
There are no.
But
there
everybody are, should.
The only exception.
Should have a camera.
No, hang on just a second, Jerry. The only exception would be if you, in the process of filming a police officer, are interfering with his ability to do his job.
Okay.
Back to you.
However, it still doesn't change the fact that if everybody had cameras and that there was more oversight, and not just on the government, but on the corporations, because the corporations are the ones that are driving the government's successes.
I agree. And in fact, you know, there's this movement, copwatch.com, I think, or copwatch.org is the website, this Copwatch movement, which is in many cities, it's largely people of color who are, you know, their commitment is to videotape with a cell phone every interaction with the police. And I think that's a great thing, and I'd like to see that expand and grow. My concern is, what do we do when every interaction with the police is being recorded by the police, and not just recorded, which I think is a good thing, but recorded in a way that is wiring you as the guy that the police officer is looking at, whether it's you just happen to be driving by or you're standing on the street as the police car goes by, or he's or she has just walked right up to you and engaged you in conversation.
How about a statute of limitation on the time that you can hold that information?
Good luck with that. This is what Edward Snowden taught us, and you know, this giant data facility that's you know, up and running now in Utah, is that you can have all those rules you want. The NSA ignores them. You know, they're keeping everything they can, and they're keeping it as long as they can. So, you know, I think with, you know, lacking a church commission, and nobody seems to have the stomach for this because there's so much money for this among these defense contractors. Lacking a church commission, I don't see a good way to rein this in. Jerry, you raised some very interesting questions. Thank you for the call. Nate in Boring, Oregon. Hey, Nate, what's up?
Yeah, hey, in regards to the whole body camera thing and facial recognition, in Clackamas County, Oregon, some of their vehicles already have it. I know this because my mother actually, she had a warrant and was picked up a month ago. The cop drove by her and turned around and arrested her.
Now, I know a lot of them are doing license plate recognition. That's easy, and the cameras are just routinely grabbing those. Do you think that was it?
She was walking.
She was walking. Holy cow. Yeah. Holy cow. Okay, thank you for that, Nate. This is not some speculative future. We're apparently already there. Thomas in Flint, Michigan. Hey, Thomas, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm actually totally against this because of the NSA reasons. I'm okay with patrol car cams, like total patrol car cams. Right. I'm cool with that because we're spying on them, okay? But when it comes to body cams, I don't want it used against us because it scares me. It really scares me. And for those who think, oh, it'll prevent it. No, it won't. If they have turned that switch off in their head, they're not going to care that they have a camera. They'll talk their way out of it like Darren Wilson did, or it broke, or it got lost, or, you know, they'll find a way to make it disappear.
Right.
We've seen too many cases of cop brutality where later we found somebody planted something. You know, it really, really scares me, and I don't want it. And it's a paramilitarization. And it's
so the problem right now, Thomas, is that if you are in a confrontation with a police officer where you're alleging that something inappropriate happened, it's your word against his, and his word is always going to have the higher standard of credibility in most courts around this country. The body cam levels that playing field. Can you come up with an alternative to do that?
Well, if I'm lucky enough to have a friend filming, like there have been other cases,
the cop watch thing.
That's an alternative. Yeah, that's an alternative. If I'm lucky to have like two or three witnesses, that's an alternative. No, I can't.
Yeah, I mean, Darren Wilson had 13 witnesses, and the majority of them said that he was trying to surrender. The majority of them.
Exactly. And that, again, that goes back to my problem, because they can come up with how many witnesses they need to counteract even the camera that says, okay, well, no, it really went this way. The camera is lying. What you see isn't what you really see.
Right.
And we've seen that even in movies like back in the 80s where they Primary Colors, where they made the clip to Larry King of him saying, oh, you want to order something, when he wasn't really even doing that. Right. We can Photoshop things. We can make things seem so. No, I'm sorry. It's a training problem and it's a paramilitarization problem. Right. This is an easy feel good solution. That's a lazy solution.
You know, there's a lot of truth to what you're saying. So your suggestion is that instead we pay officers better. We dramatically raise the standards to become a police officer. We build into the system some form of accountability that is not the local DA who works hand in gloves with the police. And at that point, the need for body cameras is diminished, and we don't have to worry about walking into the brave new world.
Exactly.
Okay. Thomas, thank you very much for the call. Interesting points. Randy in Ottawa, Iowa. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I'm great, but I'll get better.
Yeah, this is such a big issue with me, and the awareness of this issue and what's going on economically in this country, you know, with the outsourcing of tens of millions of jobs and then the influx of illegal immigrants working for less money on the job market, that if you take free trade, the deficit and how we got this deficit back under President Bush, with the creation of the NSA, I almost think we're locked into a paranoid cycle where it's inevitable that these things have to happen because you can't trust the powers that be. I think that the NSA can fabricate, if for somebody who's an activist against, say, the Farm Bureau, who in the future would have some power or would have something to say against a large corporation, the NSA could create a file to feed the system, and this poor person walking down the street, you know, by no fault of his own and probably not guilty of anything, could be picked up and thrown in jail. Yeah. So there's one other thing I wanted to mention. What you said in 2002, the 9/11 thing changed the Bush. I would go back to 2000, the Bush-Cheney energy policy. I think that was a summit of to acquire more of the prize.
Right. This is March of 2001, actually. Yeah.
Pardon me.
It was March of 2001.
Political aspirations entered into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dick Cheney was put in charge of the Energy Task Force, and they met repeatedly. They actually divided up the oil fields of Iraq.
Yep.
I mean, Larry Klayman did the lawsuit on that thing back when Judicial Watch was not quite the right wing crank. I mean, they were right wing cranks, but they hadn't. Larry Klayman hadn't yet started suggesting that we should deport Obama back to the country of his birth. But good point. Randy, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour, we'll be right back. And welcome back, 15 minutes before the hour. Ron, watching Free Speech TV in Lake Manchi, California. Hey, Ron, thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Good afternoon, Tom. Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine.
Okay, because I'm on the edge out here. Listen, we already actually learned all about this in the past. The reason why we're having this problem and we're discussing this is that we used to always have two people in a car. One was a trainee. The other guy was a veteran. And the veteran, the trainee, when they would get there, they could actually be on the side of the perpetrator. And another problem is that we have no options for perpetrators. They either go to prison or they become dead. There's no program to help people that didn't get vocational training, they don't have the opportunities. Our job market is not there. Manufacturing is not there. This is a real intricate problem. This isn't really simple.
That's a really important point. An interaction with the police cannot lead to anything good. And in many countries, an interaction with the police can lead to things that are good. For example, in all the northern European countries, if the police determine that you're having a problem with drugs or alcohol, boom, you go into rehab.
I think they had an idea here what was going on, and they did not treat this problem, and they saw it as a problem. Somebody didn't have a credit card. He didn't have the resources to actually get what he needed without causing a problem. And instead, we'll just give him death instead of solving the problem, having a program to help people actually stay out of these problems. This is also another mental nutrition. 90% of people don't get enough, and they don't get any. It's our number one problem, I think.
Yeah.
Mental nutrition.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you. Ron, thank you. Interesting points all. Rolando in Granada Hills, California, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Rolando, what's up?
Thank you, Tom, for letting me speak. I have a great sympathy for the brothers, you know, black community. They really did a great work for us, for the civil rights, you know. At the same time, they did along with the women's. You know, they stood up for the women's at the global level, you know, when it happened here. It happened at global level. So we had tremendous, we have to say thank you to them for that, you know, the generation. But at the same time, I see in the Obama, we have about 40% of the people, the old people, and 40, something, about 60% of the people who vote for Obama, you know, young people. So that was tremendous gain. And I pray, you know, that this thing that we have now, it just helped to the corporations, you know, to keep our mind from the really problem is that with this, the all sorts of jihad, you know, in other places that you're going to kill millions of people, thousands and thousands of people, again, the social security that they want to do too. You know, what I'm trying to say is that we better start to find the way that this, you know, like in the church, to trying to make sensitive to the people that go in the church, in the especially in the black church, that the problem is we have people, all kinds of people. There are good people, beautiful people. You know, Theodore Roosevelt, when they made the change, it's immense change for humanity that he did, you know. So it's not just put everybody in the same place, you know, to start to see each other as a human being that we really are, you know, that we are part
that's
of
the great work,
great, humanity that we're trying to survive at this moment, and emphasize in the problems, big problems that affect the whole community as a whole.
Yeah, that's the great work, is for us all to see each other as brothers and sisters, as human beings. Rolando, thank you. Excellent point. Thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes. Minutes before the hour, helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you on a cold, gray, rainy post-Thanksgiving Tuesday in Washington, D.C. I don't know how to describe it other than just crappy weather. It's miserable. On the other hand, you know, we could be in Siberia. Danette in Hinesville, Georgia. Hey, thanks for calling, Danette. What's up?
Hi, Tom. So a while ago, you were talking about the body cams creating a police state. And black people have lived in a police state since we were brought to this country. And all of the fears that the public is having about the NSA and about being monitored, we've lived that our entire time in this country.
Oh, sure. Look at what happened to Martin Luther King.
Well, not just Martin Luther King, but slaves were being monitored, you know, where they couldn't read and they couldn't meet and they couldn't gather in more than groups of two and things like that, where three people constituted a riot or an uprising. And that's just been the history for black people in this country. And I'm about to say something that may to your listeners sound really mean, but welcome to the black experience, you know, like that's how we've lived. And I think that there are civil rights leaders and the head of the National Bar Association, who is an African-American woman, she is recommending body cameras. And it may not be the best solution, but I think that it's something that maybe will level the playing field.
Yeah.
Maybe, maybe not. Now, what I do like about what you were saying is that you put, if the officers don't follow the rules of body cameras and have them on with every interaction, then the onus would have to be on them and they would be made responsible. And if the state sided with the citizen, then maybe that also turns the table.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? Because
I absolutely do. And if I can comment to your first point, Danette, I have been saying this for years, although particularly since the crash in 2008, although I don't say it often enough, I probably a lot of people have not heard me say it, but African Americans in this country have known unemployment, they have known the inability to get into college, they have known the inability, the difficulty getting a job, the difficulty, you know, social mobility, all those things. throughout the entire African-American experience. And you don't have to go back to slavery. You can just go back to the last generation. In fact, you can look at this generation. It is when the economy got bad enough that it started hitting the white middle class, when Reaganomics started taking a bite out of the white middle class, that's when you had the Tea Party pop up. That's when you had populists move pop up. That's when you had the political parties start taking it seriously. And I've been saying this all along. White people, welcome to the experience of black people in this country in a small way. But it's still impacting African Americans so much worse than white Americans.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And the other thing, I've not heard this so much on your show today, and I don't get an opportunity to watch or to listen to you because I homeschool my children, and it just so happens that my 9-year-old is going through a growth spurt and she's refusing to wake up. So I'm taking the opportunity to listen to you today. But people that are saying that Mike Brown got what he deserved, they're totally going against due process.
Yep.
Which is what our country, whether we use it wisely or we use it in the right way all the time, it's founded on due process and
on the assumption of innocence. Yeah.
If he stole something, then he should have been arrested, not shot to death. I didn't know that theft, unarmed theft, was a capital offense.
Right.
I didn't know that.
Shoplifting, arguably. Yeah. It's not a capital offense. And even if it were a capital offense, it's not the job of a police officer to execute people on behalf of the state. And I agree. And I'm with you.
Thank you so much, Tom. And I also just want to commend you for the fact that you cover the breadth of what's going on in the country. You don't necessarily focus on one issue, but you focus on we the people, like you say, 5 days a week, for 3 hours a day. And I really appreciate the hard work and what it takes. And I hope that you and your wife and your staff take time to relax, because living with this on a daily basis, me being a black person with two males and a husband, I live in a stressful environment a lot. Mm. And so I know what it's like. I just hope that you guys can relax and have peace at the end of the day and not have to just be under stress and strain all the time. So
well,
thank you so much for what you do.
Thank you for your consideration. We find our moments here and there. We all have to. It's survival, but Danette, thank you very much. I appreciate your kind words and your thoughtful comments on the issues of the day. Ken in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Oh, how are you doing, Mr. Tom?
Fine.
Got a comment here that may seem a little far out, but I think that it's something to be considered, especially if we have a feed going directly into a police station. I've been working professionally with sound 30, 40 years now. You can fast edit sound rather easily. If I sat in a room with you with a microphone and a piece of equipment, even if it was different rooms, I could adjust the sound around it, and I could almost make you say or do anything. So as long as the people who are handling these feeds and images are absolutely 100% honest, then, hey, fine, dandy. We find out what the truth is. I'm not so sure I want to trust that.
Wow.
It's almost 1984-ish.
Well, it's sort of the Fox News problem. I mean, you know, you get there, or the who's that idiot who runs around and, you know, busted up Acorn with a phony baloney, you know, where he walked in and said, "I'm a pimp," James O'Keefe. He says, "I'm a pimp, and this girl's a 16-year-old prostitute, and how can you help us?" And, you know, the guy just listened, you know, and as soon as O'Keefe walked out, the guy called the police. But O'Keefe edited that video to look like the guy was agreeing with him and was willing to help him. Fox News went with it 24/7 for weeks. Republican members of Congress picked it up and talked about it on the floor of the House of Representatives. And suddenly Acorn no longer exists, a great organization. Nobody had committed any crime. In fact, the opposite. O'Keefe had asserted that he was committing a crime, and the Acorn guy had tried to stop it by calling the police. And this was an example of selective editing. And O'Keefe is, you know, famous for this. And, you know, you raise a really interesting point. So presumably the response or the answer would be that we all have access through Freedom of Information Act or whatever. Somebody has access to continuous raw feed. But even then, you're right, Ken. It's all editable. Yeah, we live in a digital age. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We can still talk about body cameras and police and all that kind of thing for, you know, as long as you'd like, and then we've got a lot of calls on it. But there are a few other things that I wanted to get into today. In our third hour, by the way, John Dean's, not the John Dean of the Nixon administration, but the guy with Greenpeace is going to drop by and give us an update on what's going on with Greenpeace. But a couple of op-ed pieces that I ran across over the last 24 hours that I thought were just fascinating and wanted to share with you. The first, I'm pretty sure I saw a link off democraticunderground.com to it, but it's published over on salon.com. So I went and I got the original article and printed it out. And it's by Paul Rosenberg. And the subtitle of the article is Bush Tanked the Country. Now the right is running the show. Neuroscience explains incompetence of all sides. And the headline, it's got a picture of Scott Walker, Ted Cruz, and Rand Paul. And the headline says, why are these clowns winning? Clowns, C-L-O-W-N-S. Why are these clowns winning? Secrets of the right-wing brain. Okay, and then he gets into this the whole neuroscience thing. And he points out conservatives score higher on conscientiousness, while liberals score higher on openness to new experience. We'll go back to the founding of the Republic, and you can see that writ large. You know, the revolutionaries, the one who wanted to start a new country, called themselves liberals, and they wanted to start a new country. The conservatives called themselves conservatives, and they wanted to stay connected to Great Britain, because after all, that's the way it had always been, that's the way it should continue. So novelty seeking is more likely associated with liberals, and on the other hand, the conscientiousness, in other words, staying true to a particular groove, that's more consistent with conservatives. He wrote a piece, a 2003 meta-analysis, titled "Political Conservatism as Motivated Social Cognition." And he says, analyzing political conservatism as motivated social cognition. Now, what does that mean? Social cognition means thinking. Social, obviously, you know what that means. Motivated means that there's a reason for it, right? Something pushing it. So why is it that conservatives think, perceive, understand the world to be the way that they do with a particular motivation? What is the basis for that motivation with regard to society? Okay, so he says, analyzing political conservatism as motivated social cognition integrates theories of personality, epistemic, and existential needs, and ideological rationalization. So what does that mean? Personality. He says, personality includes authoritarianism, dogmatism, intolerance of ambiguity. These are characteristics that you find among conservatives. Epistemic and existential needs, right? The greater needs, the things that are, you know, deep inside us, that are arguably not even part of the conscious brain, but our id and superego, as it were. These include the needs for closure, to say, oh, I understand that now. The need for regulatory focus, in other words, I know how this is going to turn out. I feel safe. I don't have uncertainty. And terror management, conservatives live in a world where they're, by and large, continuously afraid. They're more afraid of the new experience. They're more afraid of what may come. They're more afraid of, and then he talks about ideological rationalization. Now, what does that mean? Ideology, you know, the way that you politically view the world. Rationalization, the way you explain to yourself why that political view is right. And so he says these are things like social justification and social dominance. They looked at 22,818 individuals in 12 countries, 88 sample groups. And he writes, Jostin, one of his co-authors, wrote in a Washington Post op-ed, he said, true, we find some support for the traditional rigidity of the right hypothesis, but it's also true that liberals could be characterized on the basis of our overall profile as relatively disorganized, indecisive, and perhaps overly drawn to ambiguity, all of which may be liabilities in mass politics and other public and professional domains. Well, this is Will Rogers, right? Back in the 1930s, somebody asked Will Rogers what political party he was a member of, and he said, I'm not a member of any organized political party. I'm a Democrat. Right? The old joke, you know, trying to get Democrats to do something is like trying to herd cats, trying to get Republicans to do something. All you have to do is, you know, lift a hand and say Sieg Heil. And everybody goes, yeah. Well, Sieg Heil is a little harsh, but you get the point. They line up and salute. Democrats tend not to line up and salute. They don't like that. In fact, I'd say that's the basis of some of this pushback against Hillary Clinton. It's not that people don't think she might make a great president, but, you know, they're offended by the idea of inevitability, which would be desirable on the Republican side. So, you know, the article, and then they go into what they call the Dunning-Kruger effect. This is the metacognitive inability of the unskilled to recognize their ineptitude. In other words, people don't realize how incompetent they are. People don't realize how much they don't know. They don't realize how much they don't understand. And so they'll say things like, you know, hey, we got to protect the job creators with low taxes, which is something that billionaires like the Koch brothers and the Walton family have literally spent hundreds of millions of dollars promoting. That idea, that simple idea, that simple bumper sticker. You got to protect the job creators with low taxes and low regulation. And what has happened? Tens of millions and maybe more, maybe as many as 100 million, a third of the U.S. population, believe this. People who are not millionaires and billionaires. You know, I had a guy yesterday call into this show and try to argue with me for five, you know, Tea Party Dave, I think he called himself, for the better part of 4 or 5 minutes about how, you know, well, saying essentially I'm opposed to all billionaires and, you know, you can't have, and I can't even really clearly say his argument other than that I kept saying, why are you arguing in favor of billionaires rather than in favor of the working class when you yourself are a member of the working class? And he never gave me a good answer to that other than that this is what I believe. This is the right thing. I've watched enough Fox News or I've listened to enough right-wing talk radio that he's come to believe, genuinely believe, this notion that if we take good care, all of us, if we transfer our wealth, we've now, since 2008, we've transferred about $4 trillion of our wealth to the top one-tenth of 1%. If we keep, and since the beginning of the Reagan administration, it's been more like about a $30 trillion transfer of wealth. Money that the middle class and working people used to have in equity in their homes. They used to have in equity in college educations that were not associated with debt. They used to have in the equity of learning potential as a consequence of college education, trade school, union membership, things like that, that are going to increase the probability of a good, long-term, high-paying job. All of this equity we've given to the billionaires, and we've lost ourselves. The middle class is lost. And the Tea Party guys go, well, that's how it should be. Why? Because they've been told that over and over and over again. And they've come to believe it. And this is that metacognitive error, I guess, that we make. So we've got that. And at the same time, there's a piece by John Edward Terrell in today's New York Times in the Stone, philosophy piece, basically, talking about the fundamental philosophical differences between the two political parties. And he points out that this idea of the individual, he asserts it came with the Enlightenment, arguably, yeah, and he quotes Rousseau. I read Rousseau differently. But basically what he says is the argument of the individual is dangerous to society.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This whole fetishing that we have done of individualism as opposed to socialism is actually destructive to us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Michael, watching Free Speech TV in Imperial Beach, California. Mikael, how are you?
How you doing, Mr. Hartman? About the police body cameras.
Yeah.
Any society that can't trust its police is not a functioning society. So with our current world facts of bailing out banks with $850 billion, $4 trillion spent on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, even if President Obama wants to spend $150 million to help reassure the American people that they can trust their police departments, isn't it worth it to help our society?
Yeah, it's chump change. And exactly. And I've been saying, you know, all along, I am in favor of body cams. That said, I have some serious concerns. I mean, you know, you could say, I could have said, although I didn't, you know, I'm in favor of Saddam Hussein not being president of Iraq anymore and there being a democracy. But is the way to get there to bomb the country and then just to, you know, basically fire everybody and wait for the magic free market? No. And so, you know, in principle, I'm in favor of every interaction between the police and the public being videotaped. In practice, I have some real serious concerns about how this gets put into place. And I think that we need to do more than just have a bumper sticker conversation about it.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah. Thank you, Michael. Good to hear from you. Kathy, watching Free Speech TV in North Versailles. Is it Versailles or Versailles, Pennsylvania?
Well, the French word pronunciation is Versailles, but it's Versailles here in Pennsylvania.
Okay. So it's been anglicized. Yeah. So what's up, Kathy?
Well, I'm calling about the body cameras. I am really, like you, I have some real, real deep reserves about using body cams because of the big brother watching you type syndrome. And, I think there ought to be more of the, people watching over the policemen, like the, police review boards. Citizens review boards and try to keep the police in line that way rather than being photographed every time you look at a cop or anything like that.
Yeah, I wonder how much. I'm guessing that the cost of the cameras is a lot less than paying police more and having higher hiring standards, right? Yeah, because if you know being a police officer were a profession where well, it is to a large extent. I mean, it's a good middle-class job. You've got a union membership in most cases. You've got a pension. You have good benefits. But if it was rather than a middle-class job, if it was an upper-middle-class job, instead of being a $50,000 or $60,000 a year job, it was a $90,000 or $100,000 a year job, and you said you've got to have a four-year education before you can get in here. You've got to have a college degree. You've got to demonstrate that you have knowledge of the law. You have to demonstrate you have knowledge of human psychology that, you know, I mean, in other words, we just, you know, upgraded our policing standards to those of Europe. I think that would go a long way without body cameras even.
And last week you said something about the doctors being watched by a lot of oversight. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, well, maybe the police need to be watched like that, too.
Yeah, it's a good point. You have physician oversight boards. Whether there are some that are run by the state, there are some that are run by the medical associations. They're all necessary in order to keep your job as a doctor. There are ways to do this. You're right, Kathy. There are ways to do this. Thank you very much for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where despair is not an option. No, there's still lots we can do and lots, you know, as I lay out in my book, The Crash of 2016, which is just, it's amazing. I started writing that book 3 years ago. Maybe even before that. But, you know, I think that we nailed the thing down and got the contract with the publisher and all that about 3 years ago. Maybe even a little bit more, because it was when we were still living in an apartment here in D.C. It was the first year we lived in D.C. So 3.5 years ago. And the hypothesis of the book, you don't have to buy it. I'll tell you what the book says. My book, The Crash of 2016, basically the hypothesis that I laid out is that just like in 1920, in 1980, Reagan basically replicated Harding's economic policies, drop top tax rate on the rich very low, deregulate business, privatize a lot of government functions, and the result of that will be a bubble followed by a bust. And sure enough, we got the bubble and the bust. In fact, we got several of them during the Reaganomics years. And then the big bust, the crash of 1929, happened in 2007, 2008 as the great Bush crash. And then in the book, I point out, you know, first of all, where did this start? It started in 1971 with Lewis Powell writing his famous memo to Eugene Sindor, his next-door neighbor, or his neighbor and the chairman of, or president or whatever he was of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, saying, we've got to get political. We being wealthy businessmen and big business. We've got to get political. We can't just sit on the sidelines anymore. Rachel Carson with Silent Spring, Ralph Nader with Unsafe at Any Speed. These books that came out in the 60s are causing government to start to regulate business in ways that we don't like and reduce our profits and you know, blah, 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 blah. And so we need to take over the legislative branch, the judicial branch, the White House. We need to take over our schools and colleges. We need to make it harder for people to get into college. We need to influence the media. We need to take over the media if we possibly can. And just the schools, we need to control the school. And all this stuff has happened now. And I document, I lay it all out in the book. And then I point out that in 2009, when President Obama came into office, yeah, he got a stimulus that stopped the bleeding. And Dodd-Frank sort of started squeezing a little bit of that genie back in the bottle. That got let out in 1999 and 2000 with the passage of Gramm-Leach-Bliley and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act that deregulated the banksters. That we sort of, kind of a little bit, but really not. We still live in a Reaganomics world, which means the middle class is going to have it worse and worse every month. There's no way around that as long as we're living in Reaganomics, as long as we've got free trade, as long as we have right to work for less states, as long as we have a top income tax rate on people who earn more than $1 million that's below 50%, as long as those conditions are met, we are going to have boom, bust, boom, bust, boom, bust. And right now we're in a stock market boom and it's going to turn into a bust. And this pushing down of the price of oil over the short term, you know, is going to stimulate our economy. It's going to make the economy look even better. And, it's going to put more money in the pockets of middle class people. And I think it's leading to another bubble. Bill Black is writing over at what's Stephanie Keller's blog? New Economic Thought, neweconomicperspectives.org or .com, about how the banksters are back to their old tricks. They were never punished before, so they're forging documents and doing phony baloney loans again. Oh, why? Because they can do derivatives. So what I suggest in the book is that the crash never ended, and in fact, it hasn't yet come to its completion. It is going to happen. It's going to happen even worse than what we saw before, because the forces that are gathering are greater than the ability of government to respond to it, particularly a government that is controlled by Republicans. We're back in many ways to 1928-29, when Republicans controlled the House, the Senate, and the White House. And you had a crash, and what's the Republican answer to the crash? Stand back and let the rich people loot the whole thing, which is what, Hoover did. And that out of that crash, in my opinion, will come a transformation of this country. Now, the question is, what kind of transformation is it going to be? Are we going to move in the direction of a police state, or are we going to move in the direction of a liberal democracy, small L, small D? Are we going to become more like the America that we've always been and getting better and better every year, more inclusive, more enfranchised? Or are we going to become less like the America we've always been? Are you going to see whites and the white power structure, principally white power structure, get more and more paranoid and more reactive? And will the tool of that reaction and oppression be a police state? It's what happened in Germany. It's what happened in Italy. It's what happened in Spain. It's what happened in Chile. It's what happened in Argentina. It's happened all over the world, over and over and over again. On the other hand, you know, we had an economic crash here, and Franklin Roosevelt came in as president, and with basically socialist policies, very progressive democratic policies, large D democratic policies, he put this country back together. And then Dwight Eisenhower followed those policies as a Republican. No Republican today could do any of the things that Dwight Eisenhower did. So my hypothesis is it's all going to go to hell. And probably around the 2016 elections, either just before or just after. That's my guess. And it's a well-informed guess. I mean, it's all laid out in the book in detail. And the question is, what is going to be the result of it? And to a large extent, that's going to be the consequence of how we all react to it. And this is a matter of getting ready for it. Because the conservative brains, right, that 15-20% of our population who are wired to be fearful and hyper-vigilant and hyper-reactive, the Dick Cheneys among us, they will fight to turn this into a police state. We have to resist that impulse.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
So body cams, the economy, we've got this economist who says, you know, I ran the numbers, the American dream is dead. And Bernie Sanders just laid out a 12-point plan. I'll share that with you later. Very pathetically ugly, the good. Jared Cook, the St. Louis Rams tight end, and four of his teammates did something extra special during the pregame ceremony for Sunday's game against the Oakland Raiders. As they came out onto the playing field, Austin and his teammates raised their hands above their arms above their heads and made the hands up, don't shoot pose that protesters in Ferguson, Missouri and around the country have been making in memory of Michael Brown. When asked why he and his teammates made the pose, Cook said that they just wanted to do something for their community. There's no rule that says that professional athletes are required to make political statements, but when they do, it's admirable. Good on Jared Cook and his teammates for taking a stand for what's right. The bad. Jeff Rurda. Not everyone is so enthusiastic with what the Rams players did last Sunday. Rurda, the business manager for the St. Louis Police Officers Association, issued this statement threatening action if the NFL doesn't punish the players behind the protest. Quote, I know that there are those who will say that these players are simply exercising their First Amendment rights. Well, cops have First Amendment rights too, and we plan to exercise ours. I'd remind the NFL and their players that it is not the violent thugs burning down buildings that buy their advertisers' products. It's cops and the good people of St. Louis and other NFL towns who do. The implication here, of course, is that only thugs and bad people support Michael Brown. Unbelievable. And the very, very ugly, Kim Krenier. The secretary of the Duval County, Florida Republican Party is under fire for sending out a racially charged tweet about Ferguson protesters. She said, a suggestion for Ferguson, fire hoses, great big fire hoses, serious water pressure, knock those thugs over. They probably need a shower anyway. End of quote. Have you noticed a trend here? Thug is apparently the new media acceptable way for white people to throw around their 2014 version of the N-word. Anyhow, now that Krenier is trying to back away from her remarks and says that her tweet about using a fire hose on protesters was supposed to be tongue-in-cheek. Right. It's remotely possible that she never ever saw or even knew about what Bull Connors did to Martin Luther King Jr.'s protesters in Birmingham in 1963. and they went after them with dogs and fire hoses. But let's be honest. No amount of apologizing is going to change the fact that what she tweeted out is just incredibly racist and very, very ugly. Mind-bogglingly ugly. Interesting. There's a piece here I am going to read during the next break. I was just looking at TheEconomicCollapseBlog.com. And the headline, guess what happened the last time the price of oil crashed like this? He says, so if you're looking for a canary in a coal mine, keep your eye on the performance of energy junk bonds. If they begin to collapse, that is a sign that all hell is about to break loose on Wall Street. Very interesting. Anyhow, Jackie in Port Townsend, Washington. Hey, Jackie, welcome to the program.
Hi. I was in Washington State. We have a two-party consent for electronic eavesdropping, unless you get a court order for probable cause.
In other words, if you're going to try to record a conversation with me, you have to know and consent to it, and you have to inform me, and I have to consent to it.
That is correct.
Both parties. Okay.
But now our state attorney general, Bob Ferguson, has issued an official opinion saying that police officers wearing body cameras and microphones do not have to get the permission of a citizen within earshot, and that every word is being secretly recorded.
Now, doesn't that make sense?
Well, they can even go into your home.
Right, but you, I mean, don't you want everything that the police do and say to be recorded?
Well, I think it's uncharted territory.
Yeah,
and we're going into a surveillance state.
I don't disagree that we're in a surveillance state and that we have the mechanism in place to be a police state. I don't think that we are a police state, but I think that it's a road that is from here to the destination is a fairly short distance compared with where America was before 9/11. But that said. If the police had to walk up to every person and say, may I have your permission to turn on my body camera and microphone before I do so, I don't think it would work.
Well, even in your own home?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, they, first of all, if they come into your home, they either A, have to have your permission, or B, they have to have a warrant. So there is some legal authority for that. If they come into your home without legal authority, I would definitely want them to be recording it because you could use that to bust them.
Well, good point. One more thing.
Okay.
The Postal Service, as it turns out, granted 6,700 requests from various law enforcement agencies to monitor the mail of Americans last year.
Right. Right. Yeah, there's more and more of this going on. That's nothing compared with, you know, what's happening on the internet, what they're tracking. But Jackie, you raise a really interesting point, and the larger point is, you know, some states have two-party consent, some states only have one-party consent, where you can record somebody else's interactions with you without their knowledge, and you know which more comports with the idea of privacy under the Fourth Amendment. Well, the Fourth Amendment only restricts government behavior, although the police are government. So, A, you can apply that there. But to what extent do we want to regulate the ability of people to monitor us or record us when they're around us? And you know, back when in order to record somebody, you had to have a camera that you held on your shoulder kind of thing, it didn't seem like that big a deal, and that wasn't that long ago. But now you can record somebody with a pen you can stick in your pocket that just looks like a pen that costs less than $100. They sell them at the spy store right down the street from where I am here. I'm sure you can buy them online for even less. And the recording is of, you know, good enough quality that you could use it in a court proceeding or you could use it to humiliate somebody or whatever. So, that's a whole separate topic, but I think it's one that's worthy of exploration, and I appreciate you bringing it up. Jackie, thank you for the call. Matt in Springfield, Virginia. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hi. One of the things that seemed odd to me was that the right wing and the Fox of Fear, they went apoplectic when some park rangers went down to Clive and Bundy's ranch, you know, to enforce basically unpaid grazing fees.
Right.
You know, the militia showed up, and it was a death of freedom, and it was armed resistance talk, all that stuff. But, you know, a young black man who's unarmed is shot by the police. Every word the government says is believed, and they're all on board. How come is that?
Because they are reflecting that authoritarian personality that is characteristic of conservatives that I described in the last segment, that you know, there's all these really good science pieces out now about that, you know, they are always Fox so-called news, right-wing talk radio, right-wing websites. You just start watching them. Just pay a little bit of attention to them, and you will find that their default mode is fear. This is, and it's not because they're trying to reach out and manipulate you and me, although that's what happens. But really, what they are manipulating is other people who are vulnerable to fear, and they themselves are vulnerable to fear. I think the kind of people who go to work in those kind of environments are the kind of people who look out at the world and go, "Oh my God, this is a scary place." And in order to make it less scary, I need more certainty. And the way you get more certainty is you bow to authority figures and you let them take over. And now daddy's in charge and I can relax. Right. And so there's this mentality that goes along with that. And if you're following that mentality, then, you know, the police, then the right wing response to Michael Brown makes perfect sense. The police are the authority figures. So they're all, you know, we always want to trust them, believe that they're true. Now, it gets a little more complicated with the Clive and Bundy thing. Had he been grazing his cattle illegally on his neighbor's land, on private land, then I doubt that this would have gotten the traction that it got, but because he was grazing his cattle on public land, on land owned by the taxpayers, by you and me, and refusing to pay for it, and still refusing to pay for it, apparently, then it became part of the right-wing meme of, we want to be safe, we want to be protected, we want to salute our soldiers and our police. We want our soldiers to be the first to board the airplanes. We want, you know, ticker tape parades. We all want to sing the national anthem. But when government does anything else, we don't like that because that's somehow a bad thing. And this is the indoctrination of the right by the billionaires, basically, and the big corporations, because they're the ones who benefit if you take down government regulation, if you take down the ability of the government to protect people in the workplace, if you take down the ability of we the people to own public lands, for example. Am I making sense here, Matt?
Yes, except I would further refine it and say that there is a fear of black men.
Oh yeah.
And it goes to the stand your ground laws have a link to the KKK all the way back to the slave patrols.
Sure.
And the violent reactions from the Nat Turner Rebellion onwards, because it's based in fear, and they want it to be legal to terrorize black males.
Yeah, because they themselves are terrified. And this is the thing that people don't realize, is that people like Dick Cheney and George W. Bush and Paul Wolfowitz and on, you know, through the list, all these right-wingers who took us to war, they're haunted by this. They are fearful little men and women. Matt, thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of your calls in just a moment. And Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service will be dropping by in about 5 minutes. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, what's on your mind today?
Well, I wanted to let you know that there's an article in today's paper which follows public announcement on TV last night that Montgomery County here will be spending $130,000 to put cameras in the deputy sheriff's cars and body cameras on the officers. This data will stream back to a computer that is hooked up to NCIS. Most people here don't understand that. But this will probably be a good thing, considering in the spring we have the 50th year anniversary of the Civil Rights March, and so maybe this will help keep things quiet in the spring.
Yeah.
But, you know, then two, when you stop and look at how divided the country is, as an economist, you will understand that when I'm also looking at an article in the same paper that says our black households here make 59% of what a white male-headed household makes. Right. And tomorrow, tie it into tomorrow's Alabama case on tax credit for a private school that hits the Supreme Court tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Can you understand why our country is so divided? We keep perpetuating white flight, which leads to an insular environment, right, and people can't even talk to each other, much less trust each other. And so we are taught to be afraid of black people. And if you never even speak to one, how can you know what they think?
Yes. Yeah, I agree. This was the thinking back in the late 50s, early 60s after Brown was,
yes,
the best way to overcome racial divisions is to have people go to school together, work together, live together, and get to know each other.
We have white flight.
Right.
We have white flight.
And now we're seeing a reversal of that over the last decade or so. We've seen the resegregation of America. And I think it's because the economic pressure that's been put, in particular on the white middle class, that pressure has always existed on the black middle class and on the black underclass. But the pressure that's been put on the white middle class is causing this reaction, this they're taking my job kind of thing. Pardon me.
Well, how can someone who works for $230 a week pay $8,000 a year for private school and get a tax credit that will cover that? This
right.
is ludicrous. This is just perpetuating white privilege here.
Yes. Well, it's continuing to subsidize the white upper middle class, or the upper middle class, let's say, which is largely white.
This causes more resentment. This causes a bigger division between our people.
Yes.
And Americans need to understand that the black people we have today have been here for 300 years, and to a certain extent, they are our relatives. If you stop and think about the things that happened, and to continuously turn your back on a fellow citizen, a fellow neighbor, and deprive them of the right to an education, the right to a job that pays a decent salary, the right to live in a house with power, water, and sewer, and the right, to deprive them the right just to walk down the street, to take a walk the way any other person would take a walk. You know, it's just, I don't know what it's going to take to heal our country, but you can't continue on with this sociological effect of just because I'm white, I'm perfect. Being white is not enough.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree, Norma. And I think that we need an economic fix, and frankly, I think we need a media fix. We've got a very, very toxic media as a consequence of this mind-boggling media concentration in the United States. Norma, thank you for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Talk media for the rest of us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. And Ellen Ratner is in the studio with us. And today is Giving Tuesday.
It is Giving Tuesday. It's a time for us to think about charitable organizations we want to give to. And, of course, I have one that I started actually when I went to Africa with you, called Goats for the Old Goat. I started for my 60th birthday. I'm not quite as old as when we went to Africa, but almost. So I felt like I was an old goat. And what we do is we give goats to hungry people in the area we were in, the Darfur and Northern Brother Ghazal region. We give female she-goats. They produce other goats. They produce milk. Which is the difference. We also make these amazing hearts for women who have seen somebody killed in front of them, and you can buy one. Also, if you have a nonprofit, we've used it to make money for Free Speech TV. You can have one in small, medium, and large, and also wheelchairs that are made for our polio people. And as you know, polio is not totally gone in that neck of the woods. So we have a lot of things at goatsfortheoldgoat.com today.
Cool. Thank you, Ellen.
So, all right, some news. So the president is going to the National Institutes of Health today. And what's fascinating about that is he's going to announce, I guess there's three companies now that are making Ebola vaccines. Well, we talk a lot about the press here. And where I don't think the press has quite done their job is we know that there is a vaccine for polio, and it's been relatively successful, very successful. Mm-hmm. Well, they've been working on a malaria vaccine for a long time, and the goal now in Africa is to have it 50% effective by the year 2015, that's next year, and 80% effective by the year 2025. What we haven't heard is what is the proposed effectiveness of this Ebola vaccine. Is it going to be an easier vaccine to develop, such as polio, or very difficult, like AIDS, which we still don't have a vaccine for, or malaria, which is not terribly effective? So, I mean, 50% is considered quite effective, but not by my standards.
Well, here's the thing. You're talking about three different kinds of organisms. You've got RNA viruses, DNA viruses, and complex multicellular organisms that have a complex multi-phase life cycle, which is malaria. That latter is always going to be very difficult to create antibodies against, because different phases of its life cycle is going to react to different things. The DNA viruses, we've gotten really good at triggering immunity in the body.
Yes, we have.
We do that with polio, whooping cough,
exactly.
Mumps, rubella,
exactly.
All these other DNA viruses.
The RNA?
The RNA viruses, which is AIDS, and there's a few other things like that. Those are really tough.
They're sneaky.
I believe that herpes might be an RNA virus as well. Thus, the difficulty with, for example, the shingles vaccine. It works, but it doesn't work for everybody. So I don't know the answer to your question.
All I ask is that the press do what Dr. Tom just did and explain it to people. And we're not getting this explained to us.
That would be a good idea.
Yeah. That's all I want out of life. Okay. Some other things today. Speaker Boehner today gave a little presser, and he said that his party has not reached a decision about what they're going to do in terms of the president's executive order on immigration, but they have looked at a variety of options. He also said,
in other words, they're still holding their breath, but they haven't turned blue yet.
Right, exactly. What he also said is that they are, the party hopes to pass Achieving a Better Life Experience Act, the ABLE Act, and he said it's bipartisan support. It will allow disabled people to have tax-exempt savings. They also want to do the tax extender bills, which you know the White House has said that they would probably veto, because it extends taxes for research and development but doesn't extend tax breaks for things like the earned income tax credit, which turns into a pumpkin in the year 2017.
Right. In other words, they're extending taxes for rich people and corporations and oil barons and corn barons, but they're not extending tax breaks
for the average Joe
or for the working poor.
Exactly. And that's what the
sounds
earned income tax credit. Well, it is. It
Surprise!
Is, Dr. Tom. Okay. And then he was asked about the possibility of a government shutdown. Lo and behold, Speaker Boehner made no comment.
Huh. Interesting.
Why am I not surprised with that? Now, there is, in fact, a possibility, as you know, that we may have a new cabinet secretary. His name is Ash Carter. And the president is looking, his name's Ashton Carter, as the new Secretary of Defense. Not a lot known about him. Probably can get through the advise and consent process of Congress. So that is probably going to happen.
Now, Elizabeth Warren has come out against President Obama's appointing a bankster to the Treasury Department. Isn't this guy a defense contractor that the president wants to appoint to the Defense Department?
I believe he has had some experience as a defense contractor. Yep. And, you know, unfortunately, it's an inside job, as we like to say.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
what can I say? All right. On presidential sweepstakes, today, Senator Rob Portman of Ohio, who ran against my cousin Josh Mandel as a Republican in the primary, Senator
Portman won.
Portman won, yeah. Portman, actually, he didn't run against Senator Josh. It was Senator Brown that ran against him. But Senator Portman is a Republican. He said he is not going to run for president. That's probably because John Kasich is, who's the governor. Rand Paul said he is going to keep his options open. And there is a group of New Hampshire businessmen and Republicans going to visit Governor Perry in Texas. This is the same death penalty Governor Perry, who might put a clearly mentally ill person to death.
Yeah, this week.
I think Wednesday night at 6 p.m. is the appointed time, if you can imagine.
Now, Rand Paul, his whole thing is going to depend on his being able to do an ALEC thing where the state changes the state law so that he can run for two offices at once in 2016.
Yes.
I'm betting substantially that they will be able to do that.
You think so?
Yeah. Yeah.
Ooh, that is scary.
Republicans basically control the state, and when Alec gets behind something, when the Koch brothers start pouring money into something.
Yeah, Alec, yeah. What can I say? Well, Alec had some support going against them recently.
Yeah.
Not enough.
But yeah, I know.
Not enough. Do we have another second here? Okay, all right.
No, we don't.
We don't.
10 seconds.
Okay.
Quickie.
Jay Johnson testified today before Homeland Security.
He is the head of Homeland Security. Okay, great. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by Goats for the Old Goat.com.
On Giving Tuesday.
Thank you. Great to have you.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 7 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the third hour of our program here on this gray and rainy Tuesday in Washington, D.C. John Deans is on the line with us. He's the Arctic Campaign of Greenpeace USA, the website greenpeace.org. Hey, John, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be back.
Thank you. Nice to see you. So what's up? This 75% chance of an oil spill if Arctic oil is produced, and what's this lease sale 193? What's going on in the Arctic?
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's a long ongoing battle. If we remember back to 2008, when the Bush administration was heading out of office, they were pushing through all sorts of energy development on federal lands, and they skipped some steps, and environmentalists called them out for that. And they essentially had this lease sale 193, which was leasing the majority of potential development areas in the Chukchi Sea, which is northwest of Alaska, just off the coast, and in the Arctic Ocean. We should keep in mind that this is an area that, even though technically has some ice-free summers, there's not enough ice to hinder the majority of traffic. This is an area that is incredibly cold, has ice flowing all over the place, is a very dangerous place to drill, and yet the Bush administration was giving these leases up, and now the Obama administration has been shepherding that. And this latest iteration comes from a challenge from environmentalists that said, look, you didn't take the environmental impacts into account accurately. And the court agreed with that. And so now what the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management under Department of Interior has done is to release a new draft supplemental environmental impact statement, essentially looking at what would the impacts of this lease sale be. For now, there's no drilling going on while this is handled. And yes, as you said, you know, one of the most stark findings in this most recent draft is that they predict a 75% chance of two large spills occurring if production and development were to happen in the Chukchi Sea.
Wow. And this is an insanely environmentally sensitive area. A couple of questions. One, with regard to the price of oil, right now the price of oil is below $70 a barrel, or in the neighborhood of $70 a barrel. And my understanding is that a lot of this, what's considered non-conventional oil, you know, exploration, whether it's fracking or whether it's Arctic drilling, is so expensive that it costs, you know, $30, $40, $50, $60, $70, some cases $80 or $90 a barrel to produce this oil. And with the Saudis driving the price down into the 70s right now, apparently trying to put out of business American fracking companies. But who knows? I mean, you know, it could also be that, you know, solar is booming worldwide. Wind power is booming worldwide. Europe is ramping down their consumption of oil radically. It might actually be that we're looking at market forces here. And if that's the case, how is that going to affect what's going on in the Arctic?
Yeah, well, these are all good points. And yeah, you know, we're seeing this game of global chicken playing out with the oil markets, and every analyst will give you a different answer as to what they think is going to happen. So only time will tell, but time is the big factor here, right? So let's step back for a minute and realize what a project like drilling in the Arctic entails. Years and years and years of exploration activities and studies. So what we're talking about with the Arctic is exploration beginning as soon as next year. Shell wants to go next year. We're obviously trying to prevent that from happening, but they go next year. It might be 10 years before they actually produce any oil out of the Chukchi Sea. So these are long-term plans. The government analysis and this environmental impact statement factors $110 a barrel price at the time of production. So, yeah, all these numbers are malleable. I think the thing to keep in mind, though, is oil companies are determined to go after this oil. Shell has already wasted $6 billion with nothing to show for it, and they keep going. They don't know when to call it quits. They ran both of their rigs aground the last time they were up in Alaska in 2012. One of them caught on fire. One of them had to be scrapped. They want to send the one that wasn't scrapped back up there next summer. So it's this, there's definitely the willpower on the oil industry side to go after the oil, whether or not it's marketable. And, these companies can hold out for months and months and months with these price fluctuations. And they're looking at the long-term game of plays like the Arctic. So it's a factor, but they're determined to go.
Yeah. So if the economy doesn't offer much hope for stopping this, then you have to go to a regulatory relief, right? Basically, regulate it to the point where it's safe, knowing that there's no such thing.
Well, you know, we are hoping to prevent oil companies from going up there, and I can sort of lay that out a little bit here. This environmental impact statement was done poorly in 2008. It was challenged again. Courts remanded it back to the agency. They took another crack at it. This is their third go around, so hopefully they'll get it right this time to at least accurately assess the environmental impacts of Arctic drilling. So that's step one. We need to make sure that people are aware that there is a 75% chance of an oil spill if oil is produced in the Arctic. That's insane. That's unacceptable. So we were up in Alaska last night at a public hearing on this, and someone had a really great piece of testimony, a young engineering student, who said, look, if the airlines had a 75% chance of something going wrong, there's no way you'd step foot on a plane, and there's no way federal regulators would let it happen. So we do need to be thinking about it that way. Once this environmental impact statement is done, though, and the impacts are accurately analyzed, Secretary Jewell, Secretary of the Department of Interior, can cancel this lease sale. The lease sale already happened. But they can change that decision. So the Obama administration has the power to actually say, look, you know, now that we've taken an accurate look at the environmental impacts, it's clear that it's too dangerous, and the secretary can negate that lease sale. And that's what we'd like to see happen. I think that's also would politically be a good move for the Obama administration. And as always, it's a wait and see.
Right.
But that's what we're going to keep working on, and we do need people to be aware of this and make their comments into the
agency. So this does not require congressional action. This is an administrative action by the executive branch.
And, that's correct.
Okay.
Yep, and the long-term game here, too, is this is step one, but the federal government every 5 years has to come up with a 5-year leasing program for the Outer Continental Shelf, which is already, you know, deemed by Congress under Outer Continental Shelf Leasing Act, or Lands Act. So that's the bigger move here, is that before the Obama administration leaves, they really need to set things in place for the next administration to keep the Arctic off limits, and they can do that. That's well within their authority. It's not a crazy executive action, like I'm sure some of our friends in Congress might like to say it is. But there's real potential here. This is a moment for the Obama administration to step up and be heroic.
Yeah. They have not been very aggressive in going after banksters. The influence of
sure.
Wall Street money on both parties is pretty hard sure. to miss. How about the oil industry? Are they principally just in bed with the Republicans, or do they have their hands into the pockets, or are they putting funnels into the pockets of both Democrats
sure.
and Republicans?
Sure. Yeah, the energy industry is pretty savvy to how to buy political influence at this point, as we've seen. And so, yeah, they tend to hedge their bets. They sprinkle their money around, so whoever gets in, they've got some ties to. So there's a certain amount of that. I think they do prioritize a lot of GOP representatives and put extra money in there. And you know, they've got the state of Alaska wrapped around their fingers. So.
Yeah, remarkable stuff. Well, John, I wish you the very best with it. People can learn all about it over at greenpeace.org. John Deans with the Arctic Campaign at Greenpeace USA. John, thank you for dropping by today.
Thank you, Tom.
And I wish you all the very best. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, you know, there's a lot going on in the world, and it's the holiday. It's the month of the holiday season when things are kind of slow, you know. So we'll just do anything goes holiday. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see here. Jesse watching Free Speech TV in Miami, Florida. Hey, Jesse, what's on your mind?
Hey, hi, Tom. Hey, you say the police and the police. I say a simple answer to that would be God. He polices all of us, and then I look at it, if you're going to use the extreme of God as one answer on one end, you say, well, what's God gives us the power to take care of ourselves. So what's the reason the police are bad? What's the reason why civilian society is given the reason, you know, the police to be bad? So what's the root cause of that? So we both are the same generation. We grew up in school where it said to solve a problem, you need to go to the root of it. If the police feel that they're not being prepared right for a society that seems to be becoming more uncivilized, where does that come from? The racism, sexism, classism. We all know when the Civil War got started, the South tried to make the argument for the black man being inferior by using science and, you know, old, you know, legend or, you know.
Yeah.
But you see what I'm trying to say? If the extreme end of cameras on all the police, a police state, what can happen if a society becoming more unequal and you're trying to keep them, you know, doing, you know, from becoming, you know, unruly, and you know that what's going to happen with that. So where's the money? Mm-hmm. That say where's the money for? Or in other words, you just opened up. You say things are slow. Say let's look at it this way. We got a private economy, the government, and we have a public economy, Wall Street, whatever.
Right.
And we know the divide between them. So that leads into the social problems. So if the people are going to try to say, hey, the government don't have enough money to pay the police and society don't have enough jobs to act normal, what's the root cause of this? So that's the, you know, roundabout question.
So what do you think is the root cause of it? I mean, you're saying this is a spiritual crisis?
No, I think it comes down to the way the culture look at property. We have patents. If you discovered cancer, you could rule the world just by saying, I got the secret formula for this, and anybody want this, they have to pay me for it.
Right.
You just imagine the person who invented the English language. If we all had to pay something to that person just to be able to speak the language.
Right.
Or just if somebody first learned how to swim and he wanted to keep it a secret, well, everybody look at how he does it and say, I could do that.
Mm-hmm.
So what gives us the right to say a certain idea is exclusively ours and everybody else have to pay us to use it?
Well, the theory was we want to encourage innovation, and that's what it says in the Constitution, that Congress can pass laws for copyrights and patents in order to encourage scientific innovation. But we've gone, you know, as Jefferson wanted them to be a maximum of 3 years, which I think was very sober. Now we have, you know, patents and copyrights that last for generations. Nuts. Jesse, thanks for the call. Always thoughtful. Thank you. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person, or Hobby Lobby for that matter? And we dare to say no. You know, Antonin Scalia's got his head in the wrong place. And his four other right-wing cranks buddies on the Supreme Court. So Bernie Sanders, I just got this news release from Senator Sanders' office. I'm sure it's up over at sanders.senate.gov. Bernie says, we once led the world in terms of the percentage of our people who graduated from college, but we're now in 12th place. Our infrastructure, once the envy of the world, is collapsing. Real unemployment today is not 5.8%. It's 11.5% if you include those who have given up looking for work or who are working part-time when they want to work full-time. Youth unemployment is 18.6%. And African-American youth unemployment is 32.6%. So what to do about this? He says, are we prepared to take on the enormous economic and political power of the billionaire class, or do we continue to slide into economic and political oligarchy? Really important questions. And so Bernie says, here's a 12-point plan to get us out of the clutches of the billionaires and reboot the American middle class. Here are his points. Number one. Invest in our crumbling infrastructure with a major program to create jobs by rebuilding roads, bridges, water systems, wastewater plants, airports, railroads, and schools. Bing! Yes, absolutely. And by the way, it would take about $2 trillion just to get us back to where we were when Reagan came into office and stopped spending money on this kind of stuff. $2 trillion just to catch up to where we used to be. Which used to be world class. Now we're kind of third world class. Number two, transform energy systems away from fossil fuels to create jobs while beginning to reverse global warming and make the planet habitable for future generations. Bing. Yes, absolutely. We could put a million people to work in the United States tomorrow morning. Insulating houses, putting solar panels on the roofs of houses, putting solar panels on the tops of parking lots, putting solar, you know, installing solar roads. I mean, there's so much at putting windmills all across the plains states. Well, not just the plains states, all over America. We have, with existing technology right now, we can produce 80% of all of our electricity at a lower cost than we're paying for oil or gas. And we can produce 100% of it at a lower cost than we're paying for oil or gas oil, gas, and coal. At 100% lower cost if we simply stopped subsidizing these fossil fuels. We can do this tomorrow. And it would put millions of people to work. The Chinese are doing this. Their solar is growing faster than anybody in the world. Number three, develop new economic models to support workers in the United States instead of giving tax breaks to corporations which ship jobs to low-wage countries overseas.
Duh.
Yes. Number four, Bernie Sanders' 12-point solution to recover our economy. Number four, make it easier for workers to join unions and bargain for higher wages and benefits. Yeah, we're going in the exact opposite direction. You got these billionaires who are funding the ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, to pass right to work for less laws in state after state. Michigan just went. Michigan, I grew up in Michigan, the quintessential union state. The Midwest, it's mind-boggling what these billionaires have been able to accomplish using their money. And in the process, stripping the middle class bare. Because poor middle class people, frightened middle class people, middle-class people with, you know, $100,000 or $20,000 in student loan debt, middle-class people who can't get a good job and are scared to death of losing the one they have, they're less likely to speak out. They're less likely to revolt. And I don't mean that in a violent sense, but you understand what I'm saying. They're less likely to take to the streets. They're more likely to say, you know, I'm sorry, I've just got to get to work over at, McDonald's here. If I don't, I won't be able to put food on the table for my family. Number five, raise the federal minimum wage from $7.25 an hour so no one who works 40 hours a week will live in poverty. Bingo. Number six, provide equal pay for women workers who now make 78% of what men make, of course. Number eight, reform trade policies that have shuttered more than 60,000 factories and cost more than 4.9 million decent-paying manufacturing jobs. Yeah, instead of shafting the TPP, we need to do away with NAFTA, CAFTA, and all the other AFTAs. I forget where we're at now. I think this is number seven. Make college affordable and provide affordable child care to restore America's competitive edge compared to other nations. Yes. In fact, I'd say make college free and provide affordable child care. Next, break up the big banks. The six largest banks now have assets equivalent to 61% of our GDP. That's over $9.8 trillion. They underwrite more than half the mortgages in the country and issue more than two-thirds of all credit cards. Wow, that's a disaster waiting to happen. The next one, this must be number 10. Join the rest of the industrialized world with a Medicare-for-all healthcare system that provides better care at less costs. Of course. It'll save us a fortune, and it'll get people well. Number 11, expand Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid and nutrition programs. And number 12, reform the tax code based on wage earners' ability to pay and eliminate loopholes that let profitable corporations stash profits overseas and pay no U.S. federal income taxes. Bingo. Bernie has nailed it. Now, in the midst of this, I told you I was going to read this article during the break, and I did. And it's pretty amazing what it says. The headline, this is over at TheEconomicCollapseBlog.com. And the headline of the article by Michael Snyder is titled, Guess What Happened the Last Time the Price of Oil Crashed Like This? And he points out that the price of oil has dropped by more than $40 in less than 6 months, only one time in our lifetimes. And that was in 2008, just before the stock market crashed. And he says, you know, 20% of the entire junk bond market is made up of junk bonds for oil companies. They're using it they're raising money with junk bonds and using that money to frack and drill all over the country. Now, if the price of oil stays low, those companies are going to go out of business, which means that the junk bond market is going to collapse. If that collapses, it takes down the whole stock market with it. So the net of this, keep your eye on the junk bond market, particularly the energy sector.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Because when the junk bond market in the energy sector starts going south, the whole thing is about to collapse. And if anybody can tell me how to keep an eye on the junk bond sector, I'd love to know, because I don't know. Call another time. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And during the break, Shana was busily digging through the bowels of the internet and discovering, that's a pretty lousy phrase, isn't it? Sorry about that. Anyhow, and discovering that there are two exchange-traded funds of junk bonds that we found, or that he found, and he shared with me, showed me. And both of them, what are the acronyms? JNK from Barclays, HYG maybe from iShares. And they're both basically junk bond funds. They're not broken out by sector as far as we can tell. We haven't had an opportunity to really drill down into them. But they both seem to be collapsing, right? Or dropping. I shouldn't say collapsing, and I don't want to create a financial panic or anything. But they're both going down right now. And you look at the 10-year window on them, and you can see what happened in 2008 with these funds. And they went down a lot. And it looks like they're heading in that direction. Now, on the other hand, the Dow is up. Dow is up 89 points right now. And so, you know, the stock market seems to be just shrugging it off. So time will tell. Time will tell. I am not a stock prognosticator. I can talk macroeconomics all day long. I can even do a pretty good job with microeconomics, but when it comes to stock market stuff, I don't know. I'm continuously horrified by the fact that the changes made during the Reagan administration in executive compensation so that executives could be compensated with stock used to be illegal. And the changes that were made during the Reagan administration so that pensions could get basically pushed aside and Social Security would be weakened, and instead average Americans would be encouraged to think like billionaires by putting their money in the stock market through a 401k and IRAs. These were horrible things for this country, and these were horrible things for the American middle class. The you know, people say, oh, it's freedom. You can control your money. I'm sorry, I've got other things to do with my life. I would really like to know that when I'm 65, I can retire based on Social Security. And I don't have to think about it. I don't have to worry about it. I paid into it my whole life. I mean, you know, but unfortunately, Republicans and a few Democrats, too, have drilled so many. But in particular, Reagan's big reform of Social Security in 82, 83. You know, now a lot of people, you know, won't even be eligible for Social Security until they're 66, 67. There's people talking about raising it to 70. Come on, give me a break. But I digress. Helen in Ithaca, New York. Hey, Helen, you wanted to talk about what Rick Perry's up to down in Texas?
Oh, hi. Yeah, good afternoon. Yeah, I'm touching again on something real quickly that Ellen Ratner just mentioned, that this man named Scott Panetti is scheduled to be executed tomorrow. You know, and he's a chronic paranoid schizophrenic deemed incurable, and he was not medicated while he was in detention in Texas. So he has a severe mental illness, and even I'm not a libertarian, okay? So Ron Paul had made a plea to Rick Perry, I guess, to, you know, do not execute this person.
Really? What was the basis of Ron Paul's argument?
I don't know. He's a I don't think like libertarians.
Right.
I'm like a socialist, okay? So, but he said that you cannot execute this person because he is
mentally
crazy,
ill. Yeah.
You know? And he didn't know what he was doing.
Yeah.
And he fired his attorneys. He went into court dressed like a cowboy, and for witnesses, he called the Pope, Jesus Christ, and John F. Kennedy. So none of those three persons appeared, and this judge just let him represent himself. He's obviously incapable of doing so. His attorney's name is Catherine Case, based out of Houston. She's affiliated with this Texas some kind of defense organization, and
one of the Innocence Projects kind of thing, or something.
Yeah, that type of thing. But it, in front of the Pardons and Paroles Board that they have there in Texas, it was a 5-4 vote. 5 said execute the guy, and 4 said don't execute the guy. So, and he's scheduled, I think it's 6 p.m. tomorrow.
That should require a consensus, you know. When we're talking about taking somebody's life, it should be 100%. It shouldn't be 51%.
Hey, I got a better solution. Why don't we just join the rest of the civilized world and abolish the death penalty?
Oh, yeah. You know? That's top of my list. Very well said. Helen, thank you for bringing that back to all of our consciousness and reminding us that the number for Congress, of course, for the main switchboard is 202-225-3121. I suppose you could indirectly apply some pressure on Rick Perry by calling the two senators from Texas or calling, you know, any member of the House of Representatives from Texas and complaining about this. I'm not sure how to directly speak to Rick Perry. Do you know?
I don't, but I've called everyone I know in Texas to ask them to do this.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, and if you know anybody in Texas, call them and ask them to raise some hell. Helen, thank you very much for the call. Excellent point. And thanks for listening to AM 1470 there. Rick, listening to AM 950 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Yes. Hello. Say what you were talking about before regarding which way the country will go.
In the event of a major crisis like an economic crash?
Yep.
Yeah.
I think it depends on the paradigm that we come from. I read a book called The Chalice and the Blade by Rhianne Eisler.
I know Rhianne, and I've read her book. She's a good friend.
Powerful statement.
And her husband, David Loy.
We come from a fear-based culture or a cooperative love-based culture. Right. And whether it's capitalism or whatever, you know, I think capitalism could work if it had the right paradigm, but we don't. We have a power over paradigm, and right. we get what we get.
Yeah, I agree. And Rhianne Eisler is one of the great thinkers of our time. Her husband, David Loy, wrote a series of books on Darwin's theory of love, basically debunking this whole idea that Darwin, you know, survival of the fittest stuff, that Darwin was actually a big collaborative cooperatist, you know, nature cooperates with itself, all that kind of thing. And Rhianne's stuff on The Chalice and the Blade and there's a whole series of her books that I read way back in the day. And I've had lunch at their home in California. They're just wonderful, wonderful people.
Yeah, and I've heard a lot of people complain about capitalism. Tom, do you think capitalism could work if it had the right, you know, the power with chalice type paradigm?
If the way to do that is to regulate it aggressively, and we have seen capitalism work when it's well regulated. When it's not well regulated, capitalism is predatory. Capitalism is fundamentally sociopathic and predatory when it's not well regulated. It's like having a person without a conscience. A corporation is, you know, a person at law, and yet it has no conscience built into it.
I agree.
And in fact, all the incentives are upside down. You know, if as the CEO, you're doing your job right, if you're increasing profit, even if that means you're laying off workers, that's sociopathy. I think that there is
one more comment.
Yeah, quickly.
A problem I have with some of the Republicans is they keep saying no to everything.
Yeah.
And I think that we as liberals or whatever who care about climate change, we keep saying no to fossil fuel and no to fracking and all that, which I think is important. But I also think we need to have something to say or what to do instead. And that's why I'm a big fan of learning about more about algae oil fuel as a positive alternative to fossil fuel.
Yeah. Yeah. We have to come up with liquid fuels, high-density liquid fuels, and it looks like algae actually may be one really good option for that. Hemp is another good option for that. Or basically, you're using it's a biological solar collector rather than an electronic one. Excellent point, Rick. Thanks for the call. Michael in Seattle. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Let me put you off the speaker.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm a former commercial fisherman, worked up in the Bering Sea in the Gulf of Alaska, and we were targeting in primarily on the North Pacific walleye pollock. To give you some context, these schools back in 1978 when I first started working for NOAA were often 50 nautical miles in diameter of solid biomass. This is an incredibly dynamic fish species. Consequently, it's the only fish species that we target in on commercial fishing that's still a relevant fishery today. In other words, it's not, we've been managing it from the very beginning of our use of it. The reason I bring this up is because these schools are very migratory. They use the entire North Pacific Ocean from the eastern side, which is our western seaboard, all the way to Japan. And they're also up in the Bering Sea, and they use the whole ocean in order to maintain these gigantic schools. The reason I bring this up is because in the process of processing these fish, even though they're not exactly on the bottom, they're pelagic fish, meaning midwater fish, they do aggregate in close proximity to the bottom, especially during the daytime when the sun's out. What I've seen in the process, and this is years before Fukushima, back in the 80s and early 70s, is that over the period of my career working with these fish, is that more and more I would see examples of tumors and stuff in the fish themselves.
Mm.
Now, the reason I think this fish is an important one with regards to the subject of the Fukushima is because these fillets and the streaming analog they used to make fake crab and fake shrimp and all that kind of stuff gets processed at sea, but it's put in as a commodity. It's stored in large volume and then released to the public as, you know, the expiration date comes up, et cetera, et cetera. So what I'm concerned about is that at some point somebody's going to walk into a McDonald's and get their fish sandwich, and it's going to glow in the dark.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a legitimate concern. The radiation from Fukushima is getting here. Also, you said they swim in the Arctic Sea or not?
Well, it's a very large, I fished all the way from the Mexican...
I got to run, Michael. It was a quick question. Could they be vulnerable to an oil spill, I guess, was my question. We're out of time. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with your calls in just a moment, 15 minutes before you. Welcome back. Jim in Sullivan, Illinois, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I was watching a show about all the different, about Obama arming the police. That, you know, he's going to still do it because people don't realize three little words, New World Order. That's what we're going into. People forget about that.
We're already there.
Wrote about it. Yeah, people talked about it for 100 years, and, you know, just people don't read about it. In fact, I'm reading a book by Jim Mars a second time, you know, Rule by Secrecy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and explain step by step what's happening. You know, I read this 45 years ago. They're going to collapse the economy. Not that long ago, I watched a documentary on Link called Ethos, narrated by Woody Harrelson. And Aaron Russo, he's the Republican candidate for Libertarian Party, a few years back. He had a best friend named Nicholas Rockefeller. And this was before 9/11. And when they were drunk, Rockefeller was telling him, you know, laughing, you know, he says, something's going to happen soon that's going to change the world. He says, people are going to be in, we're going to put people in fear. And, you know, it can be Googled. Aaron Russo is talking about it on his show. And he says, their goal is to put, and Aaron asks him what the goal is. You're rich, you're powerful. What do you need? Anything else? He says, we want to control everything, basically. They're going to put chips in the, you know, in cards and everything. So, you know, your show may be gone in 5 years because...
Jim, this is not exactly rocket science or revelatory. I mean, in 1998, Jeb Bush, for goodness sakes, signed a letter to Bill Clinton saying you've got to invade Iraq, the conquest of the world, you know, expand American empire, get that oil. As Dick Cheney famously said, 10% of the world's oil, very important oil. I don't think this requires some giant evil conspiracy. It just requires a bunch of people who are opportunists.
Your phone's clicking out again.
My phone's clicking out? Can you hear me now? You can't hear me now? Uh-oh.
No.
No? Okay. Jim, I'm sorry. We got to figure out what's going on with our phone. We've got a problem, I think, with our telephone provider. We will get beyond that. Brian in Mesquite, Texas. Can you hear me, Brian?
Yes, hello?
Hey, Brian, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We got a minute. It's all yours.
Yes, Scott Panetti is going to be executed at 6 tomorrow.
Right.
He's a schizophrenic, was hospitalized 10 times before his trial. He was allowed to be his own lawyer dressed in a purple cowboy suit.
Right.
I was in court just this past Halloween. A court officer was dressed as a 10-foot-tall Grim Reaper, full makeup, sickle, everything.
Whoa.
That's how they do it in Texas.
Whoa. And you bring a paranoid schizophrenic into a courtroom where one of the court officers is dressed as the Grim Reaper?
Well, no, that's two separate things. His case was long ago.
Yeah.
But I was in there just on a probation violation just this 2 months ago on Halloween.
Right.
A month ago on Halloween. And they allowed a community supervision officer to be dressed as the Grim Reaper, 10 foot tall, on mechanical extensions on his legs. Even the other employees of the court complained it was the third year in a row he had dressed like that.
Yeah, I'm with you. Brian, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the end. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mary Jo, listening in Minneapolis, Minnesota, to Minnesota's Progressive Voice, AM 950.
Yes, Tom, I hope you can hear me because the phone does keep going out. I mean, your phone, I think.
Uh-huh. I hear you fine.
So I think everybody who's listening would love to support you, but let's say they have limited funds. Let's say they have $150. What's the best way they can support you? Is it giving money to Free Speech, buying podcasts?
Free Speech TV, which carries our program as television, is having their fund drive right now, and so they're looking for donations. That's supporting Free Speech TV, and that's a fine thing. In terms of supporting us and our program, you're listening on a commercial radio station. Call the sponsors and let them know that you're listening. Let them know that you will recommend them to other people. Patronize their sponsors. I'd say that to any of our people who are listening on a commercial radio station. If you're listening to us on a non-commercial radio station, and Mary Jo, thank you for the question. Thank you for calling. If you're listening on one of our Pacifica affiliates, we're on Pacifica radio stations all across the country. They live on contributions, so you can just contact your local radio station and make a contribution. And it's not, mention our name. I mean that helps. That keeps us on the air. It causes them to stay with us. The one thing that we directly do that raises money for this show is we sell podcasts, but I would only buy that if you're going to listen to it. I mean, you know, it's just, we're doing okay. Free Speech TV is supported by donors. The nonprofit stations are supported by donors. They need your help. And our for-profit stations right across the board, the holiday seasons tend to be a little better than others, but it's not a really good time for commercial radio in the broad sense. So if you are listening on a commercial radio station that is supported by advertisers, please call the station, let them know you're listening, but more importantly, call their advertisers. Back when we lived in Portland and I was doing local radio as well as this national show, I would, have lunch with the advertisers, and if I said something like that on the air and they got one or two or three phone calls, the owners of the business would just go nuts. This is just wonderful. People are actually listening. People, it doesn't take a lot. You can have a lot of impact with just a couple of simple phone calls. Jim in West Palm Beach. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention something. I haven't heard anybody talk about it, but I remember in the 70s, this is in referral to the police violence, police shootings of innocent people. Back in the 70s, that was a big deal. That was very common. And there was a lot of cops carried guns in the back, Saturday Night Specials, and they would call them throwdown guns. So they'd shoot the guy, and then they'd put the gun in his hand, and sometimes they'd fire it first, and then they'd put it in his hand, but then they'd have the excuse why they shot him and killed him. And what they a lot of people noticed was that a lot of these were Vietnam vets. There's the post-traumatic syndrome involved in this thing, I really believe. I don't know about the latest with the Michael kid, but
Darren Wilson has no military background, and most police officers don't. A lot of people do come back from the military and go into policing. It's a logical thing. You've been taught how to use a weapon, and particularly if you've been an MP, but generally, and I think that there is a reason to be concerned in that a certain amount of deprogramming is necessary when people come out of the military. But that's not just, and Jim, thank you for the call and raising the issue, that's not just for entering the police department. That's for life, right? I mean, we raise people, we raise our children telling them don't kill. The first law, don't kill, right? Don't kill other people. And then we take a couple of years out of their lives and they say, we're going to suspend that law and we want you to go over to this place and kill as many people as you can. And then when you're all done, come on back here and don't kill anymore. And that's a really, really difficult thing for a lot of people to deal with. And it's one of the reasons why I think it's every 11 minutes a veteran in the United States commits suicide. It's breathtaking. And it may not be quite that frequently, but it's very frequently. It happens far more than it should. And it's because of that cognitive dissonance, that internal conflict between knowing what's right and wrong and having done something that you believe is wrong and yet you were told to do it and you had to do it, you had no choice, et cetera, et cetera. So the one thing that I think that we need to be careful of is stigmatizing our returning vets, though. I mean, let's not make it harder for them to get a job when they come back, even if that job is as being a cop. That said, I really think that the military needs to do a better job of deprogramming people when they get out of, in particular when they get out of war zones. We're not handling that well, in my opinion. Andy in Wilmington, Delaware. Hey, Andy, what's up?
Yes, hi, Tom. I have two quick questions. One is, during one of your breaks, news breaks, you mentioned a number, over 60,000 manufacturing facilities have been shut down over, 20 years? Is that what?
No, it's since 2001.
Since 2001. Okay. Can you think of any other country that would not have red flags going up when they started to lose, when that something like that was happening? Do you have any other country that would almost celebrate this?
Not in the developed world, but there's also no other country in the developed world who has a Supreme Court who has said that the billionaires spending money is a constitutionally, in order to buy politicians, is a constitutionally protected right.
Okay. I just wondered if you knew of any other case where this was okay.
No, I don't. There's an interesting piece in the New York Times by Paul Krugman, I believe today, called, you know, The Problem with Europe. And he points out that, you know, even Germany has a trade surplus. Most of these countries, if they have a trade deficit, it's a fairly small trade deficit. France, I think it was France that he pointed out specifically, they have almost no trade deficit. It's a very small one. We have a massive trade deficit. Our trade deficit is bigger and worse than our budget deficit. And it's the deficit that we should really and truly be freaked out about. And you're right, Andy. Nobody's talking about it, and they really should. EconomyInCrisis.org, I think, is one of the best sites on this. Andy, thanks a lot. And I wrote a book about it called Rebooting the American Dream. The first chapter starts out with that international trade and what Alexander Hamilton had to teach us about it. He was the guy who first put into place our trade tariffs that built American industry over the next 200 years until Ronald Reagan came along and blew the whole thing to hell. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com, everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.